WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello, and welcome to WrestleSpective Radio at FairToFlare.com. I am Jason Mann, and joining me once again is Joe Drilling. Joe, how you doing?
I'm good. I'm good because, you know, we're first of all, we've done like, this is like the fifth or sixth one of these main event podcasts I've done with you, and love doing these with you, by the way, but this one is near and dear to my heart because this is the first WWF pay-per-view that I ever attended live.
Yeah.
And so this is a near and dear one to me. And it's also weirdly fitting because the last WWF pay-per-view, WWE pay-per-view, Elimination Chamber, also the February pay-per-view, also from Milwaukee, 10 years later.
There you go. Well, that's a nice little juxtaposition.
Yeah. I wasn't at that one, though, because I don't pay for those kind of tickets anymore. But I did back then. And so
this is the second to last WWF pay-per-view altogether, I think.
Yes, that's right. There were no more WWF pay-per-views very shortly after this.
Right, right.
There were only WWE pay-per-views after, because we had to get the F out because of the panda.
We did. And this is a very, very strange era in WWE. Like, kind of, you know, the invasion of 2001 through really into 2004, 2005, just a lot of bizarre things that WWE is trying to do and trying to, in different ways, recapture the magic of WCW or the magic of the WCW WWE rivalry, and having moments where it works, but a lot of moments where it doesn't work. And this is kind of step two in that direction, or maybe even step three, because step one was obviously the invasion, you know, bringing in mostly low-level guys with your Booker T and your DDP and having WCW invade. And
well, no, hang on a second. Booker T was the world champion at that time.
No, I meant low-level guys plus and Booker T.
And Booker T and DDP. I'm sorry.
Who were stars but were not the biggest,
not Sting, not Ric Flair, not
right,
the NWO.
Right, exactly.
I gotcha.
Then step two was kind of, and I guess this was part of step two, because step two was bringing Ric Flair as the co-owner and then having him and Vince be rivals, and then Vince kind of upping the ante by bringing in the NWO. And this show is built around the debut of Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, and Hulk Hogan coming to WWE, you know, for the first time in forever, and reforming the original NWO.
Yeah, and you know, that's interesting that this is what happened, because Milwaukee back in the day was not a huge wrestling territory. I mean, it was in that if you were going from, so say you were the AWA, and you were doing shows in Minneapolis and Chicago, which you would be, because that was, you know, the AWA's territory was the upper Midwest. You would stop in Milwaukee, because why not, right? But Milwaukee was never like wrestling hotbed like Minneapolis, like Chicago, like, you know, a lot of these places. But
well, they did the Crusher, though.
Yes, the Crusher is the wrestler who made Milwaukee famous. Yeah. Reggie Lazowski, and he passed away a few years ago, but he is a legend in Milwaukee. Came down to the ring with the beer barrel, you know, the quarter barrel on his shoulder, and a big cigar, and roll out. His entrance music was Roll Out the Barrel, in a time when a lot of guys didn't even have entrance music. You know, and yeah, he was a multiple time AWA world champion, big stars. Him and Dick the Bruiser were multiple time AWA tag team champions. And he wrestled all over, though. He wrestled in all the different territories. You know, he had feuds with Bruno Sammartino and in other territories and things like that. But and he was obviously, when he was the champion, he was huge in Milwaukee. He got over big time in Milwaukee, of course. But you know, in the territory days, Milwaukee was not a hotbed. It was really more of a stop between Minneapolis and Chicago.
Sure.
But since the national days, since WWF and all that stuff, a lot of weirdly noteworthy things have happened in Milwaukee. King of the Ring 1996, the birthplace of Austin 316, that was in Milwaukee. The reforming of the NWO at this pay-per-view we're talking about here, that was in Milwaukee. The first Taboo Tuesday was in Milwaukee, which is, I gotta be honest, that's a concept. I don't like having a pay-per-view on a Tuesday. I think that's stupid. But the whole fans vote the matches and stuff, I think that's a good concept. And I'm not sure why they changed it to Cyber Sunday, because, you know, having a pay-per-view on a Tuesday is stupid. They changed it to Cyber Sunday, but I don't know why they've done away with that, why they don't keep doing that pay-per-view. I think that's a sound idea. It gets the fans involved. And, you know, I like that concept. I don't know why they stopped doing that.
I think it always did badly. I think it was like the worst drawing show every year. I think that was
really?
Kind of the reason. Yeah.
That blows my mind. I'm not even kidding. I think that a pay-per-view in which the fans could have direct input on how the show would go would do big numbers, which I guess is probably what WWE thought too. And apparently we were both wrong.
I think the issue is that people like to know what's going to happen in the show before they get it. And the voting adds too much uncertainty is sort of the theory. But anyway.
Yeah, I suppose. But, you know, things... Now, this is not the show that I ever went to. The first show I went to, my uncle took me when I was about, I guess I would have been 5 or 6. And it was when Ultimate Warrior was making his ascension toward the world title, and Hogan was still huge. And Hogan had a match with Andre, and I don't remember if it was a tag match where it was like Hogan and Warrior versus whatever, but my uncle still talks about how impressive it is to see Hogan body slam the Giant, because that happened on that show. So that was the first live wrestling show I went to. My uncle took me when I was little, but this is the first pay-per-view, and it was a big deal, man. We knew the NWO was going to be there, and that was like, oh man, we're going to be there live when the NWO makes their debut. Mm-hmm. In WWF, and we didn't know that it would kind of turn into a train wreck, which it did. As you said, it was sort of the invasion was handled so, like, I mean, obviously historically speaking, we can go back and everybody has looked at it, we've talked about it, it's been talked to death by, you know, the invasion was handled in just an amazingly poor type of fashion. And the problem is, and I talked about this you know, with our buddy TH, wrestlers are marks for themselves in a lot of times and in a lot of cases. And a lot of times that that leads to them making poor decisions. What's even worse is when a promotion is a mark for itself, you know. And the thing is with the invasion, Vince owned all of it. So if WCW has won matches, or if the invaders, the coalition or whatever, what were they called, the alliance, had gotten wins or had gotten a leg up on their own with their own guys, that doesn't matter, because Vince owns them all. Like, they lose, like, somebody along the line in the chain of command lost sight of that. And so it turned into, well, we'll just have WWF guys defect, and then they'll be the bad guys, and then we won't ever really. And, like, you know, we talk about this, and, like, they didn't buy out all these contracts from Time Warner, but then they ended up paying even more money. Like, they could have brought in Nash and Hall and Hogan for part of the invasion, and that would have made it, like, 8 million times better.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't. They could have brought in Goldberg at that time, but they didn't. But then they ended up bringing all these guys in within a year or you know, a year or two in Goldberg's case after the invasion, and paying, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 times as much as they would have paid just to buy out their contracts from Time Warner.
I'm not sure if they – I don't know if the finances are quite right. I think some of those Time Warner contracts were really expensive, so I don't think they – I think they paid a little bit less for them later, but they probably would have – the money they would have generated probably would have been more. They probably would have come off ahead if they had done it then. But I do think the contracts were, especially like the Goldberg ones, were really high, which is why they, you know, didn't want to do that.
Some of them were, but I feel like I've read somewhere in what I would consider to be a fairly reliable source that some of the Time Warner contracts, since they were partially met or because they were buying out the company, they were at a semi-discounted rate. Or so there was something strange where, like, some of those at least would have been less than they ended up negotiating independently later down the line just to bring them in a vacuum outside of that context.
Yeah.
Not all of them. I'm sure not all of them. I'm sure the Goldberg one, they probably would have paid more for Goldberg at that time. But again, it would have been worth it. Cause you know what everybody wanted to see was Goldberg versus Steve Austin.
Right.
That was what everybody wanted out of the Alliance. You could have brought Goldberg in and had him lead the Alliance, or him lead WCW or whatever. And I can't even tell you how excited I was. Like, that Raw where Van Damme and Dreamer came down and interrupted that match, like, that was amazing. That was mind-blowing. Like, my friends and I were like, oh my god, this is so great. And they just proceeded to completely screw it up. Like, the whole invasion thing was totally screwed up. So it's almost like they're trying to recover from that by doing the NWO thing again. And again, the concept is sound. We were super excited to see this. And again, they just managed to completely botch it. Like,
right.
Eventually you have Kane being teased as joining the NWO at one point, and like they bring X-Pac back as member of the NWO, the Booker T's in the NWO for like an hour.
Yeah. And Shawn Michaels was in it. Shawn Michaels was in it. Yeah. He turned on Austin to join it. Yeah. They watered it down really quickly. Yeah. And part of that was because the fans took to Hogan so much, and they had to turn Hogan, and they, you know, went with him getting the, you know, being the old Hulk Hogan and being the good guy and doing that thing, which, you know, was big and was the thing they needed to do. But, you know, it was just, you know, I think they really, from the beginning, and we'll talk a little bit about sort of how they debuted, because basically the first thing that happens in the show is they come out. And then they do
now. Well, on Sunday Night Heat, they had an infamous segment with The Rock, where The Rock cut a hilarious promo on all three of them, where Hogan asked for a picture with The Rock for his son, and then The Rock says, you know, or then Hogan said, makes some snarky remark under his breath as he's walking away, and The Rock cuts this promo about, you know, Hogan, or no, you Chico Razor Ramon, you take that camera and you shine it up and you hand it to your buddy Big Daddy Cool Diesel, he turns it sideways, and then you give it to Hogan, and he sticks it straight up all three of your candy asses, and that. So that happened on Sunday Night Heat before the show actually started.
Oh, I didn't realize that, because I saw it when I watched this whole show, and I saw it then. I didn't realize it was like a pre-tape thing.
I think that was I'm pretty sure that was a.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
That was a Sunday Night Heat, because that was when Sunday Night Heat was on. I don't remember if it was still on MTV or if it was on. Were they on TNN at this time?
They were on TNN at
Spike
time,
or whatever.
Yeah.
So it was on TNN. I don't know if I remember if it was on MTV or TNN or whatever before the pay-per-views.
Right.
But they had to broadcast the Sunday Night Heat beforehand, and none of the DVDs have those matches on it. Like a couple of them do, but most of the DVDs don't have any of the Sunday Night Heat stuff on them, and that bugs me. And I'm just putting that out there right now. That bugs me.
Maybe we need like a best of Sunday Night Heat DVD. Like, you know, we have a best of like Nitro, best of Raw, you know.
Best of Sunday Night Heat. That's
yeah.
Right.
So,
but then they come out to the ring. That was the opening of the pay-per-view, if I remember correctly, is they came out to the ring.
Kevin Nash talks first, and he talks forever and says nothing and is really boring.
A Kevin Nash promo.
Right. And then Scott Hall says that they're marks and that, you know, and then they make a weird allusion to Hall's like alcohol problems. Like, you know, Hall says they just want to hang out and have a drink. And then they like, no, you can't have a drink, Scott. And like, wink, wink, nod, nod. And basically the idea is that they are clearly being disingenuous, but they're saying, hey, we're not bad guys. We don't want to take over. We don't want to destroy this company. And the whole reason they're there is because the idea of Vince McMahon wanting to inject poison. Because it's like, you know, Flair is now half in charge, and he, and McMahon wants to destroy what he created. They do this really weird thing on SmackDown where Vince is like talking to a mirror and or he
didn't know it was a mirror. You didn't know it was a mirror.
He's like talking to the camera, and he's like, you think he's talking to somebody. You can't tell when he's going crazy. He's going insane. I want to inject the poison, blah, blah, blah. And then he ends up like turning the chair, and then you realize it's a mirror, and then on the chair there's the NWO logo.
I can't even tell you. That sounds so stupid when you describe it like that. I marked out so hard when I saw that.
It was really cool. Yes, I did describe it, and it did sound stupid, but yes, it was absolutely cool. I remember it being a spoiler, and so I heard about it first and then saw it. And
see, I had not been spoiled on it. So when he turned the chair around and it had the NWO logo on the back, and he's like, me and the NWO. Oh, I was like, oh my God. Like, and I was trained by this. Like, I was wrestling at this time, and I was still like, that is awesome. Like, even though I was already working matches by this point. Like,
sure.
But like that whole thing, like it did a lot to flesh out Vince's character, I think, in an important way, because essentially Vince, the character of Mr. McMahon, and who knows how closely related that is to the actual Vince McMahon, but regardless, the character of Mr. McMahon is so megalomaniacal that he, in his from his perspective, Ric Flair was destroying the company he had spent his life building, and rather than let Ric Flair do it, he decided that he was going to accelerate the process, because if anyone was going to destroy the WWF, it was going to be Vince McMahon, who had built the WWF,
yes,
which is why he brought in the NWO. Right. And I liked that. I still like that.
Okay.
I think that it makes sense from the perspective of that character, mm-hmm, because Vince is, that's the whole thing. You know, they come up with ways, sometimes contrivances, to make it so that Vince, for whatever, whether it's the board of directors or the contract or Shane signed a contract or whatever, there's always some contrived reason why, even though Vince is the owner of the company, he can't just impose his will against someone he doesn't like. So Steve Austin, he can't just fire Steve Austin because, right, he's under contract and it's a legally binding contract, and if he fires him, he has to pay him more money than he wants to pay him.
Or whatever.
Or
yeah,
he could go to Ted Turner, or, you know, the board of directors won't allow him to fire Steve Austin, or whatever the thing is. There's some contrivance of why he can't just impose his will, mm-hmm, but you see that he wants control, it's complete control over everything at all times, and he wants everything to go the way he wants, and as an extension of that character, that's why his feud with Austin worked so well. That's why this thing, I think, worked until it didn't, which didn't take long, I'll be honest. But yeah, the NWO comes out and they say they're not going to do anything. And I don't remember. See, I didn't rewatch the whole show, and you did. So after this initial appearance by the NWO, where they say we're not here to rock the boat, we're not here to cause a ruckus or take over, that's silly. We just want to wrestle. Do they appear again until the match that we're talking about here? Do they appear?
Well, they twice. Once the thing we mentioned with The Rock, which I didn't pick up was something that happened earlier.
And I'm fairly certain that was on Heat before it was on the actual
show.
Maybe not. I might be remembering that wrong.
They have an interaction with Austin, which is shown before the one with Brock.
Is that the one where he hands him a beer? Like someone hands him
Paul hands Austin a beer,
and he opens it and just throws it, or he throws the six pack behind him or whatever.
Right. He says, he does the what thing on Hall, and then he says, I ain't thirsty, and he dumps the beer, and then they sort of like, they do a stare down, and then he lets him through. But I, going back to the NWO first interview, then Hogan gets the mic and gets a big reaction. You know, even at that point, he was getting the big face pop. And I do have to, one highlight of this, I will have to say about Hogan disingenuously saying, God bless Vince McMahon, God bless all of you, and last of all, God bless America. Thank you to the fans. I will have to say that I did enjoy that. But I feel like really we needed instead of the mock, the mock sincerity, we needed we're the NWO, we're going to take over, we're protected because Vince has us and no one can touch us. That can be the kind of their excuse for being able to run roughshod.
Right. They were even allowed to be drafted as a unit during the inaugural brand extension draft.
Exactly. Right. I mean, that kind of thing. Like they, we've got the power, Vince, behind us. You know, we can do anything we want to, blah, blah. We're going after, you could say, hey, we're going after, we're going after Jericho, we're going after Austin, we're going after Triple H, we're going after The Rock. You know, we're going after the top guys. We're targeting them. I mean, if they had made that and just cut like an angry promo saying, you know, we're taking over, that would have been so much more effective than this mock swerve that no one was meant to believe and certainly didn't believe. And even, you know, Ross and, well, Lawler sort of openly pulling for and justifying the NWO. Lawler's playing full heel here, which I kind of forgot he sort of was doing in 02.
Yeah. He had done that for a long time.
He sort of stopped doing it during the ad, like during, especially in 2000 when he feuded with Taz. Like, even before then, I think when he came back, which was late 01 from his, like, he was not for 8 or 9 months, he was, you know, he left. And then Heyman was commentator through the invasion stuff. And then night after that, Lawler comes back. So I think he was sort of openly heel for a few years after that. The other weird thing is them, like, I know it sort of fits with the story of openly blaming NWO for causing the demise of WCW, but it's such a weird thing to have, bring these guys in. And they were like, these are the guys that killed that other company. It's sort of like, they killed it. I guess it's just because I'm, you know, an educated fan, and I don't mean to be pretentious about saying that, but I understand the real reason why WCW died. And they're sort of using that in the kayfabe thing too. It's just sort of a weird thing to bring up, you know, instead of like, these guys are like killer and they did all these things and they, you know, they're, you know, it's like they killed the company with their egos and, you know, and getting their way and stuff. It's right. Like, it's sort of strange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a little blurring of the lines there, I guess. And yeah, I guess with their, I don't think they're trying to remind us that their egotism is what was the undoing of WCW, but just that they were such a, I think it was more trying to illustrate like that they were such a force to be reckoned with in WCW, and that they did run roughshod over the company, and not so much did in some ways have an effect on the end of WCW, just because they did have such massive egos and paychecks, and you know, that Nash and Hall had a deal where anytime anybody started making more than they were, they had to be given a raise to be equal to whatever they were making in WCW. So I don't think they're trying to necessarily remind us of that. Although, as you said, if you're aware of the history and what went on, you kind of.
Right. I feel like they were doing some wink, wink, nudge, nudge stuff. Maybe right. It wasn't as blatant, but I definitely feel like they were putting out that vibe at least a little bit. But you know, what have you. So basically, yeah, they open the show, they have a couple of other segments, and then we get to the main event. But in the first mention of Jericho in this entire show, I believe, is in a graphic before a WWF New York segment, right before the semi-main event, which is Kurt Angle and Triple H. And it was in this WWF New York segment is humorous because it features a Mr. Perfect who appears to be not bombed out of his mind, but he's definitely under the influence.
Tipsy, for sure.
Yes, right.
He's a little more than tipsy.
Right. He does some sort of like weird like speech. He refers to the women in the crowd as rats, and
which doesn't make any sense if you don't know what that means. Like,
right,
he says rats. He says even the rats here are ugly.
Right.
Which, if you're not aware, ring rat is a derogatory term for essentially a wrestling groupie. A ring rat is a wrestling groupie, a woman who sleeps with wrestlers just to sleep with, like, just because they're wrestlers. Like, and so that's, wrestlers refer to ladies like that as ring rats. So so it'd be weird to hear someone say even the rats are ugly, because you'd be like, well, rats are ugly.
Yes,
they're,
yes,
rats. Like, but that's not what he means, and he's obviously too inebriated to to realize.
Yeah. And he takes his coat off and he flexes and the mic's in his back. And yeah, they cut him off pretty quickly on that. But that's sort of amusing. But the point that I make of Jericho's first mention is, you know, Jericho is the undisputed champion. He won both titles a couple months before.
By defeating The Rock and Stone Cold Steve Austin in the same night.
Yes.
He and WWE will never let you forget, by the way.
No, which is good. That's an important thing. Yeah.
That is.
But they certainly didn't really treat him like, I feel like Jericho is the first champion, and this is a commonplace thing now, to not be number one or number 1A on the show. Like, he is maybe the seventh priority at this point.
Well, wait. So we've got the NWO who just showed up. So right. let's run down what the standings on the card are at this point. So we're talking about the number one babyface is obviously Steve Austin. So in that respect, the number one babyface is still in the main event. The number one guy is still in the main event because it's Austin.
Okay.
I would say even with Hogan being there, I would still say Austin is the guy.
Okay. Well,
so in that way, the number one guy is still in the main event. But the champion, so we've got Austin, we've got Rock. So Rock is clearly the number two guy if Austin's the number one guy, right?
Yeah. I would say that Triple H at this point, because he just come back and he was so hot returning at the Royal Rumble and right before. So he might even be the number one guy ahead of Austin and Rock, sort of temporarily. I think that top three is kind of fluid. And in any case,
in any case, those three guys are the top three guys.
Right.
For sure.
Yes.
And so Triple H, Rock, Austin, Undertaker.
Right.
Who is
a heel. Who had just recently turned heel, too.
Yes, and was doing the biker taker gimmick, which I still don't like.
Right.
I mean, his matches were still good, but I never understood the decision to do that. I never liked it. I still don't like it. when I look back on those matches, I mean, he has like the match he had, the first WrestleMania match he had with Triple H at WrestleMania 17, when he was doing the biker gimmick, is really good. Better than the one he had last year, which is essentially, if for anybody who hasn't seen last year's WrestleMania match that they're making a big deal out of now, but this is the big rematch, it's essentially Triple H hits the Undertaker in the head with stuff for 20 minutes, and then the Undertaker wins out of nowhere. Like, that's the match, and it's boring to me, at least. I thought it was boring as hell. The one he had at 17.
I actually loved it.
Did you? Okay.
I did.
Well, I guess different strokes for different folks. I thought that match bored me to tears. I thought it was, for those two guys, I was expecting, and I just watched the match from WrestleMania 17, like 3 days before the pay-per-view, and I was like, this is going to be great. And it was not at all. And I think the match they had at WrestleMania 17 was really great. So he had great matches when he was doing the biker gimmick. But it's just like, sure, the Undertaker is this bigger-than-life character with all this supernatural mystique. And whether you can read it as he can throw lightning or whatever, which is kind of silly. But even if you read it as just like, this is a man who plays head games with his opponents and is very, very effective at it. It's just such a great character. And to take that character and be like, he's going to be a biker. I'm like, okay, great. Awesome. He's that. What? Why would you do that? So he's doing the biker gimmick, but he's still having good matches. And he's still obviously a major star because he's the Undertaker. So you've got those three guys and Undertaker. Then I would say after them, now the NWO has shown up. So you've got those guys. And I would even say Angle might even have a higher place on the card than Jericho, or is a bigger star than Jericho at this time. So I'd say Jericho might be like the ninth most important, eighth or ninth most important guy on this show.
Yeah.
Which also speaks to the depth of the depth of the roster at that time.
Sure.
You know, to have that many guys in a position, which is similar to now. I've heard people say that now they feel like there's too many big stars or too many guys at the top of the card. And for my money, my personal theory is you can't have too many big stars. I mean, if you got 10 guys who will sell tickets to shows, 10 guys who you could put any one of them in a title match at any time and the crowd will buy it, I fail to see the problem.
Yeah.
Like, you have an embarrassment of riches with your performers. I don't know why that's a problem.
I guess the only issue that I can see with that is if you need to keep those 10 guys happy and you can't have them lose or lose very often, and then suddenly there's no room to grow middle guys up to that level because they're kind of clogging the way, so to speak, which I kind of think sort of happened a little bit in WCW. And it maybe even at times in WWE.
I think the problem with WCW was they had an embarrassment of riches in terms of their talent. And we talk about this in the What a Maneuver podcast a little bit on the first episode. They have an embarrassment of riches. They have guys that are great, especially like 1996 WCW. They have all these guys, these matches, like, dude, TV matches that shame so many of the TV matches you see now. Like, you know, Benoit versus Regal, free TV match, 15 minutes long on an hour long episode of Nitro. Like,
right.
Oh my God, this is, but they never elevated those guys beyond that. And it wasn't because they had a glut of stars at the top, because really they didn't. They had Sting, Hogan, Flair, Savage. You know, those were their big at the time, yeah. In 96. Like, those were the guys who were, and Hogan was always floating in that main event picture to the point where it was like, you know, at this point, John Cena, for example, like, you could make that claim about John Cena, but John Cena now has been out of the world, not out of the world title picture, because really at any moment, the beautiful thing about having that many stars is if John Cena becomes the number one contender the day after WrestleMania, no one is going to be like, that doesn't make sense. Why would nobody buys John Cena as the number one contender? But he doesn't have to be, you know what I mean?
Right.
And you can keep elevating. Like, at this point, they've elevated Wade Barrett to the point where I think they still think they need to commit to an angle with Wade Barrett. But with Wade Barrett, you can look at him and go, if he is in the title picture. I mean, he wrestled at Elimination Chamber and nobody scoffed at, I mean, people scoffed at Santino, which I still thought it was great to have Santino in the Elimination Chamber match, but yeah. Nobody scoffed at Wade Barrett. No one was like, that doesn't make sense. And Wade Barrett had been sort of gradually elevated to, I mean, obviously his feud last year with John Cena helped that a lot, or 2 years ago, I guess that was now, with a year and a half ago with John Cena, made a lot of headways there. But they keep elevating these guys and getting them to the point where, like, believably you can be like, that guy's in the world title picture, I buy that. But then if they're towards the upper mid card, you're still like you believe Dolph Ziggler. Like, if Dolph Ziggler decides that he's going to go after Jack Swagger for the U.S. title, which obviously they're stable mates, that doesn't make sense. You know what I mean? If Jack Swagger, or I'm sorry, if Dolph Ziggler's in a fight over the U.S. title or the Intercontinental title, most fans are going to be fine with that. If he has another title match, if he gets the number one contendership after WrestleMania, fans are going to be fine with that too. It's just a matter of using your guys, you know, the best way that you can. And again, like, as far as the win losses thing and keeping him happy, that turns into, I keep harping on this on podcasts lately, but like, guys being marks for themselves. I'm like, you have a role to fill it and you got to fill it. And, you know, Jericho could lose every match between now and WrestleMania and make it work, make it look good, and still make him look like a legitimate contender to CM Punk's title. There's a way to do that. You just have to be smart enough to do it.
Sure.
And whether the bookers are or aren't is another matter. But I still think that, you know, there's no such thing as having too many stars. Yeah. More guys selling merchandise, more guys selling foam fingers, more guys selling DVDs, more guys selling tickets, more guys, you know, I mean, what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
You know, depth in a roster is never a bad thing to have.
No, I agree with you. I just think I can see, I think if you manage it and make it work well, it shouldn't be a problem. But I can see where if you don't, or if you run into suddenly you have too many mouths to feed, so to speak, then I can see where that can be a problem. Now, you know, there are ways to control it, but it certainly, I can see it kind of raising up and being an issue. But I do think, you know, yeah, if you can create a bunch of stars, and the more the better, no question about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So here we've got the same thing, an embarrassment of riches, because this is very shortly after the WCW's gone, ECW's gone, so everybody's going to WWE.
Right.
Which, of course, the embarrassment of riches is what leads to the brand extension, which is coming a couple months after this pay-per-view.
Sure, sure. But I will say that I do think that Jericho's, the lack of him being a focus of the show, I do think hurt the reaction to the WrestleMania main event that he was in.
Yes.
Triple H.
Agreed.
So,
agreed. Yeah. Jericho was booked like a chucklehead. This, from the time that Triple H wins the Royal Rumble until the time of the WrestleMania main event, Jericho is booked like a complete jackass.
Right.
In a way that, I mean, that match is still good. If you go back and watch that match from WrestleMania, without skip over the Hogan Rock match, you know, and the crowd is kind of dead because they're exhausted from the Rock Hogan match.
Sure.
But if you just watch the match, it's a good match. It's just the story surrounding it is stupid. And the fact that they put on Hogan Rock before it, or directly before it, is really more than anything, is detrimental to it. But the match itself is not bad. The match itself
is
good.
It's okay. I mean, it's fine. I don't think it's bad. I mean, obviously the reaction is the problem, but I think as far as the work is fine, you know?
Yeah. Right.
So we have, kind of the lead into this is, there isn't really anything particularly wonderful about it. I think Austin wins the number one contenders match over Angle, sets him up. They sort of, you know, fight with each other, doing things. I know they have a thing with Jericho attacking Austin and pouring beer on him, so on and so forth. And then Austin sort of like teasing, like attacking Jericho, and Jericho like running away, like in fright kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, I will say that one thing that I don't think helped Jericho very much during this time was his ponytail. That was not a good look for Jericho.
He didn't. I always liked the little top of the head ponytail thing that he did in WCW and a little bit in WWE. But he just had it's like braided, but like the ponytail part is dyed red, kind of.
Yeah, I don't know. I have a problem with ponytails in wrestling. I'm just not a fan. They always look awkward to me.
Now he had the Rob Van Dam made a career out of his ponytail, I think. Well, but I can see that. I'm not sure that I necessarily it draws that much focus for me, but it's a ponytail. Yeah. Ponytails in general are not name a cool dude with a ponytail.
It's hard. There are not that many that can pull it off. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Yep. So Jim Ross, in fact, he mentions during this time that in the commentary that Jericho hates being called a transitional champion, which it's funny that they're sort of acknowledging the fact that no one really buys that Jericho is going to be a long-term champion.
Right.
Everyone sees that he's going to, you know, him in Triple H, pretty much everyone sees it's going to be him in Triple H and, you know, gets that and whatever. But it's funny how openly they're acknowledging that. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't say it quite in those terms, but you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I think everybody knew. I mean, I knew that as a fan. I clocked that as soon as Triple H won the Royal Rumble.
Right.
I mean, maybe even before that. As soon as we knew Triple H was coming back, essentially, it was like, okay, Triple H is going to win the Royal Rumble. He's going to go to WrestleMania. He's going to beat Jericho.
Right.
Which is fine. I didn't think that Jericho wouldn't get another title reign for like 7 years, though.
Right.
That he needs it. I mean, he does, you know, not that he needs it to be over, but you know,
right.
It's just strange.
It is. It was sort of odd. I do think that I'm sort of interested in what would have happened if they decided to go with Austin Triple H. Even though they would have been both in baby faces, they still could have had like the, they had a story from the previous year, of course, them doing the two-man power trip and Triple H getting injured. And they could that could have been interesting, or it being a three-way, Austin, Triple H, and Jericho, which I think would have been sort of an interesting idea. And given that Austin Scott Hall was pretty awful as a feud and as a match,
which is too bad because it didn't have to be.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, Scott Hall looks terrible here.
That's true.
Not as terrible as he looks now, but I mean, he looks pretty rough. No. And he was clearly past his prime. I mean, I always thought that Jericho Scott, or I'm sorry, Austin Scott Hall was just like, Scott Hall, I mean, at that point was not even like nearly on Austin's level, you know?
No.
Like Nash.
In terms of it, both, I'm guessing, but do you mean, just for clarification for the listeners' purposes, do you mean in terms of his standing as a star, or do you mean in terms of his in-ring ability?
Both.
Or,
you know, I meant standing as a star, but I think this is really the time where Austin sort of falls below the Rock in sort of the, and Triple H, but that was more of a temporary thing, in the pecking order and in where he is seen in the fans. I think The Rock getting that Hogan match instead of Austin was really what kind of made like The Rock sort of the number one guy and Austin the number two guy.
Well, so, I mean, we talked about this a little bit before we started recording, but according to Wikipedia, if they're to be believed, and I take anything I read on Wikipedia with a grain of salt, but Austin, it was supposed to be Austin versus Hogan at WrestleMania, and allegedly they wanted to put Hogan over, and Austin said no way.
I've read Austin's book, and I recall it being that Austin just thought the match would be bad and didn't want anything to do with Hogan and didn't have much respect for Hogan. But I don't know if it was so much a Hogan was going over thing.
Okay. Well, according to Wikipedia, and again, I take it with a grain of salt, that
sure.
Allegedly both of them refused to put each other over. Hogan said, "I won't lay down for Austin," and Austin said, "I won't lay down for Hogan."
Yeah.
So then Hogan ends up laying down for The Rock, but I don't. You can't give your guys those kinds of options. I mean, obviously, once you're that big of a star, there's a problem there, obviously. But I mean, you know, Hogan, I just feel like Hogan's ego is so out of control. Like that SummerSlam match with HBK. Can someone explain to me why Hogan had to win that match? Like what was the purpose of that? Why bother? You know what I mean? Like, and then he allegedly refused to have a rematch where he would put Michaels over, you know? And it's like, dude, you're in your 50s, late 50s. You know, you're not going to be back next week. Sean's going to be back next week, next month, next year, having world title caliber feuds, and you can't put over Sean because what? Because you're Hulk Hogan, and that's just how it is. Like, you know, it's just that kind of stuff about Hogan just totally rubs me the wrong way. His ego is so out of control that, you know, it's gotten to the point where it's like borderline embarrassing. No, you know what? I take that back. It's not borderline. It's embarrassing. Like, Hogan doesn't realize, I think, that his time has passed. And you'd think all the time he's been spending in TNA at this point and everything that has happened and transpired, he would realize that his time has passed. But no, he doesn't. And he just has to be the star all the time. And I think that's detrimental, you know, to do. I'm glad he did business for The Rock. Because I tell you, man. Again, I was working matches by this point. I had just started working matches at this point in my life when this pay-per-view happened. And going into that WrestleMania, I was wanting The Rock to win that match so badly because I was terrified that they would put Hogan over because he was Hogan. Not even like a screw job finish. I would have been fine with that. But like they were going to put Hogan over The Rock clean in this match. And I'm so glad that they didn't. They put Rock over Hogan. But yeah, you're right. I mean, Austin just slides down the card at this point, and Austin is, you know, vocally displeased with what's going on here.
Yeah, I felt like the character really fell flat, kind of, after he turned back from being, you know, a heel at the end of the Invasion stuff, and. Really through 03 and 04 when he's in the non-wrestling role, but is, you know, kind of like he and Eric Bischoff are co-GMs for a while and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Like, it really just felt like, I'm not saying he was going through the motions, but it just felt like that. Like, it felt like he was not really bringing much new to the table. And I have all the respect in the world for Austin as a performer. I mean, I think he's so awesome and had so much range and was really incredible, but
yeah,
this is not a fun era to watch him.
No, actually, this is not really a fun era. So we're getting out of the good, like these matches. This show was generally good. Some of the stuff that followed is okay. And then once we see Sean come back, he has a lot of great matches. But generally speaking, like this is the period where I, as a fan, and remember, you're talking about somebody who was having wrestling matches at this time, who loved wrestling possibly more than any other thing in the world. You know, not necessarily people notwithstanding, of course, you know, but I mean, like in terms of hobbies, things I did with my spare time, things I sunk my time into, you know, wrestling was the thing at this time in my life. And I all but stopped watching WWF probably for most of 2003 and 2004, and I'd portion of 2005.
Okay.
Like, stopped. Would occasionally watch Raw here and there, would read about what happened, and just instead watch tons of DVDs, Japan tapes, old school stuff, like, all kinds of... Like, I was still watching wrestling all the time. It just wasn't WWE.
Mm-hmm.
Because the shows didn't got... Just that period, I don't know. The initial brand extension stuff, like, again, really, like... 04, I remember, I feel like, is when was the Mr. America stuff?
Oh, that was 03.
That was 03, yeah. So 03 was like, I was still kind of watching it semi-regularly. 04 is where, like, I dropped off and I was like, this is so bad. I don't even know, like, this is the, I don't know what's going on here. I can't watch this anymore. And I think most of 04 I didn't really watch with much regularity.
Yeah. I definitely cooled off in my interest during the 02 to 05 time. I mean, I would still watch Raw, or at least I would know the results and would follow it pretty closely. Mm-hmm. And I knew what was going on. But I definitely was less interested. And, you know, I graduated from college in 02 and, you know, was starting a career and got married and, you know, and those things and was busy a lot of Monday nights too. I'm sure that had a lot to do with it, but yeah, I don't think I withdrew quite as much, but I definitely cooled down on WWE in those years and probably even into like 06 and 07. I kind of got back into it, you know. It was sort of just randomly kind of started watching more regularly here and there. And I still go through fits and starts where I watch it more regularly than other times, you know, it just sort of depends. Mm-hmm. I mean, I always at least keep an eye on it and know what's going on basically, but
yes, yeah. Lately, I mean, just, I feel like lately it's, especially at the depth of the roster, not all of the booking makes a lot of sense, but I feel like in the last couple of years, they've really upped their game in terms of making me want to watch, especially the stuff with CM Punk. Now that they've got Jericho back, like, I'm Daniel Bryan is the champion. These guys that nobody thought would ever get a shot. You know, that interests me now, but we're not here to talk about current stuff.
Sure.
You know, but yeah, this is sort of the very beginning of a lot of that stuff, of that sort of downslide to the point where I'm not watching anymore. But Jericho as champion, I was so happy for that too. It's, you know, because I had been a fan of Jericho since WCW days.
Oh yeah.
And you can see him as a fan not getting raised on the card. And like I said, we talk about this a little bit on the first episode of What a Maneuver podcast, where it's just they had all these guys in WCW, and the problem is they never elevated any of them. They held them all down, they held them all back, and then they all went to WWF.
Right.
Because why wouldn't you?
Yeah, and then, you know, and most, and a lot of them became huge stars there. So.
It went to great success, right. Obviously. So, you know, and so it's great to see Jericho as champion. This match, I knew he was going to beat Austin. I didn't know how he was going to do it. I didn't think he would do it clean, and of course he doesn't.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a surprise the NWO interfered, obviously. I mean, you know, you figure, okay, they're going to go after Austin and Rock, and that was going to kind of be what, you know, they would do. That just made sense.
Right, that's what they were brought here by Vince McMahon to do.
Exactly.
You know?
Right, so. Yeah. So, one thing and the other thing in the setup I thought was interesting is that Austin calls himself a drug addict for the WWF championship. Interesting choice of words.
Yeah. I don't know if that's a cut on Scott Hall or just a poor choice of words.
Right. Yeah.
What happened there, but,
sure.
Yeah.
So they have a stare down to start. Interestingly enough, they both seem like they're close to the same height here, and I always thought that Austin
was
quite a bit taller than Jericho.
Yeah.
So yeah. Now Austin has his head down a little bit. He's kind of bending his head down a little bit, so maybe that's part of it. But yeah, I was like, oh, these guys are roughly the same height. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. So they jaw for a bit. Jericho gives him the finger, and I love how calmly Austin just sort of shrugs it off and gives him one back. Like, it's like Austin doesn't get pissed off at all. He's just sort of like, all right, you know, I'll give you one back. And then Jericho gets Austin in the corner. Austin shoves him off. They do a lockup and they get the same result. Jericho gets in a right hand, catching Austin a bit off guard, but then Austin sort of like just smiles a bit, and Jericho is aghast that, you know, his vicious blow has not been met with you know, the proper respect.
Yeah,
I will say both guys, like, this is a nice little match. Like, I remember this match not being regarded as being particularly good. And I think the finish is a little flat because the NWO run-in really doesn't, like, come across very well. I think it's because Paul doesn't really hit a very good stunner, and they don't really do, like, a whole lot to hurt Austin leading to the finish. But as far as, you know, kind of the story they do before then, like, there's some fun stuff.
Like, okay, here's my problem, and I messaged you about this while I was watching the match before we started this podcast.
Yeah.
There, I almost want to go back and watch it again and keep track of how many chops.
There are a lot.
In this match. Like, it's like any time that they're between spots, they can't figure out what to do, or they haven't decided what to do next, or they're like transitioning to the next spot or the next thing, one of them chops the other guy like four times.
Right.
Like, there's got to be 100 chops or more in this match. I'm not even exaggerating.
And here's the weird thing. Austin does not use very many punches here.
No.
And Austin,
he chops instead.
Yeah. And Austin, you know, I mean, obviously, like, you know, Austin's punching is like one of the things, you know, he was known for. I mean, you know, the big fists and, you know, the Luthes press and falling with the fists. I mean, you know, particularly when he was at his peak, you know, in terms of popularity, that, you know, 98 through, you know, 2000, he was doing all these brawls, you know.
Yeah.
So it's just weird to see. I mean, I think he throws some late in the match, but he does not do very many punch. I don't know if that was just a conscious thing where he changed his style, or maybe they just WWE 1 did not do as many punches, or I don't know. But just kind of interesting. So.
Yeah. And like, I don't know. For that reason, like, I just don't – there's not a lot of variance in the offense.
Yeah.
Not that I'm a big guy in terms of, like, you know, I think work rate is kind of a word that was made up. Like, I don't – that's not – I never heard a professional wrestler use the term work rate.
Okay.
Never did we ever – when I was working matches in the indies, did we ever talk about, man, we got to make sure our work rate is up, or, man, what's our work rate? Like, that's – wrestlers don't use that word.
I feel like it's always been, like, a word I don't quite – like, I get what it means, but I feel like, yeah, it's not really very useful.
No, it's not. Like, because basically what does it mean? Like, it means – you know, they don't use rest holds. Like, okay, well, guess what, man? You get in there and see if you get tired or not. Like,
right.
I mean, you know, but so I hate that term, but like, really, I don't think there needs to be a ton of variance in offense, because you can watch some old Memphis matches and stuff, and like, practically all they do is throw punches. But like, they chop so much, dude. I can't even, it's unreal. Like, how, and that just, to me, like, there's nothing going on. It's like, oh, and now I'm going to back you into the corner and chop you a few times. Yeah. All right, body slam, get up, go to the corner, and I'm going to chop you a few times.
Yeah.
And now we're going to go to the outside. We'll brawl there for a little bit. I'm going to chop you a couple times on the outside. Then we'll get back inside, and I'll chop you a couple times. Like, I cannot accurately convey to the listeners who haven't watched this match recently how many knife-edge chops are in this match.
Well, yeah, I mean, it starts off with, you know, basically Austin hitting him with a dozen of them in the corner. Then he rams his head in the turnbuckle.
I like the turnbuckle because it's the crowd is chanting, and I was right there with him, you know, chanting what? Every time he hits Jericho's head into the buckle. Then Jericho drops to his knees and he rams his head into the middle buckle a whole bunch of times.
That was great. Yeah. Yeah.
Instead of counting like people did in the Hogan era, they just are, everybody's just saying what, as he's pounding his head into the,
right. And this would have been the peak of the what thing. I mean, people still do the what chants during, like, to interrupt heels, or occasionally baby faces, as they weirdly did with the Undertaker on the most recent Raw.
It's almost just a way to mark the cadence of a promo. It's like the crowd is like a human metronome.
Yes.
With the what chants. I almost don't even notice them anymore, honestly, because it's been, you know, over a decade since people started chanting what, that I just don't even, like, I...
Yeah. It was something that was, I liked when Austin would do it. I never really liked when the crowd would do it. And I really, I still notice it now, but, anyway, that was kind of the one thing that was cool that ended up being completely awful pretty quickly. But so yeah, and then and Jericho's chest is pretty red. I mean, we he has an Austin hits him with a couple suplexes, more chops in the corner, and Austin just pounds on him for quite a while. Dumps him outside, chases him. Eventually, Jericho gets a swinging neckbreaker off the ropes to sort of to get a little bit of a break. It's at this point that Jim Ross says that if you told Austin he would never be champion again, he'd go to Texas and we'd never see him again. I found that to be
oddly prescient.
Yes, exactly. given, Austin, because, there's the famous Austin walkout in
it's like 2 months after
May, May or June. But he also he walked out the night after WrestleMania. He walked out that day too, and then they kind of smoothed things over, and he was back. I don't remember what that one was about. The second one
that I think that was about the Scott Hall thing, and he didn't think that he was being used. And again, it's troublesome because I've ranted a lot lately about guys being marks for themselves, but there is a point where if you're a star the size of Steve Austin, you've done as much as you have for this company. You brought wrestling back from the brink in a lot of cases. The NWO had a big factor there. But, I mean, Austin, for as much talk as people give for, Hogan and Rock being the big crossover star, like, Austin is, I think, raw numbers-wise in terms of viewers, regular viewers, pay-per-view buys, merchandise sold. I think Austin is the biggest star, in professional wrestling history. And to take someone like that and give him a 7-minute match against Scott Hall at WrestleMania, I can see being insulted by that if you're Steve Austin. You know what I mean? And it goes beyond being a mark for yourself to the point of just being like, okay, really, guys? Like, really? Like, this is what I've done for your company, and you gave me a 7-minute match against someone who can barely work anymore.
Yeah, I would definitely say that Austin – I would agree with you. I mean, obviously didn't handle things maybe in the right way. And seems like he was going through, better. I mean, he was going through a lot of other things that, came out in his personal life and came out in troubles. And he wrote about that in his book as well. I mean, he was just going, through a lot of health stuff too. I mean, obviously he had his neck injury that ended his career and was, that was bothering him and so on and so forth. But I mean, Austin had spent the last year, he turned into a villain, after WrestleMania 17, 2001, and really never had quite the same relationship with the fans, at least not for a few years after that. I mean, he still was a popular guy. He still was their, one of their biggest stars and all that, but he just wasn't quite as transcendent as he had been before then. And so I think, that kind of maybe fed into the paranoia is like, okay, my career, maybe not like totally messed up, but screwed up a little bit. I'm not quite as big as I was. This creative team keeps giving me stupid ideas, that kind of thing. Business was falling down at that point too. I mean, just a whole lot of things that I think kind of fed into, maybe why things weren't working out or why he wasn't getting, what he, getting the top things. I also think, I remember there was like a Bite This, which was like some great, the online show where he,
that was also the show where Lita talked about her affair with Matt Hardy openly. Her affair with Edge when she was like engaged to Matt Hardy. And yeah, I remember Bite This, but yeah, there was a similar thing, right?
Where he called in. I think that was right before the second walkout where he buried the creative team and then, so a lot of stuff going on in that situation, and so on and so forth. But as far as just Austin as a performer, and you have to consider how close his career was to ending at one point, and then, And you know, of course, he lost a lot. He had to have the neck surgery and lost a lot of time, and so on and so forth. But he really did save WWE. I mean, without him being there when he was, I mean, if his career had ended in 97 and he hadn't been around 98, like the wrestling landscape would be so different. Like I'm not even sure WWE would exist.
Right.
You know, right.
That is definitely an argument you could make.
I mean, they would have had The Rock. I mean, you know, maybe they would have been able to build around him. I mean, it's not like they definitely wouldn't exist, but it's certainly a possibility.
Yeah. Well, they were, I mean, from what I understand, they were pretty close to the brink before Austin broke through. And The Rock, I mean, even at that time when Austin broke through, The Rock was still a year or two away from really hitting
exactly.
his stride as a huge star. And that year or two may not have been enough. I don't know how close to the brink they were. I guess that year or two might not have been enough. I mean, but you can't even imagine somewhere there's a parallel dimension where, you know, WCW bought WWE and then AOL still shut WCW down and there's no mainstream professional wrestling on TV anymore.
Right.
What a horrible world that must be to live in. But
sure.
You know, I mean, yeah, Austin did more than his fair share and definitely is a huge star. And again, you're absolutely right. He could have handled that better. There's no doubt that, you know, walking out is probably not really the answer, especially when you've cultivated a relationship with your boss like he had at that point. There's probably a better way to go about that. But either way, I understand why he was frustrated. But he still obviously is at the top of the card in this match. He's in the main event. He's having a – I don't know, man. I feel like these two guys can just have a much better match than this one, you know, because – so many chops. I can't get over it.
Okay.
They can't think of what to do. There's more chops. I'm going to watch it again. I'm going to make tally marks. I'm going to find out how many chops there are.
Okay.
Like, but well, it's just.
It's funny. Even Lawler mentions at one point, he wants to know if Austin has to pay royalties to Flair for it because of all the chops.
Yeah, like I kind of have it on in the background now while we're talking about it, and like literally, I've just seen 7 chops in a row from Steve Austin.
Right.
And now he has Jericho back in the ring. Well, where did we leave off?
Jericho got the swinging neck breaker. Then Jericho gets some chops in the corner, knocks him down with an elbow. He goes to the top, but then runs into an Austin punch. Then Austin clotheslines him over the top, and then we get some more chops repeatedly on the outside.
Yeah.
And. Yeah. Then we're back in, and then Austin gets some repeated shoulder thrusts in the corner. So he's you know, varying the offense a little bit there. Definitely relentless. I mean, he's definitely really aggressive with the offense. It's just sort of a different offense than I'm used to. Obviously, you know, mostly with the chops. He misses a charge in the corner. Then they go outside. Apron jumps off the apron and attacks Austin's shoulder. They fight to the entranceway, and then Austin tosses Jericho into one of the 18-wheelers that are part of the set.
Yeah, there are more. You missed more chops in there, by the way, because I'm watching it where we're talking about it right now, and there was just like 6 more chops from Jericho.
Well,
and so like, I cannot drive home enough how many chops there are in this match.
Right.
Yeah, they fight to the outside, and. You know, we just saw an ambulance match on the pay-per-view recently. Where there was a lot of brawling on the outside, of course, it's an ambulance match, which I feel like, didn't we just talk on a recent one of these that we did for some other recent pay-per-view?
I think it was Starrcade 2000, yeah.
Yeah, we were talking about ambulance match. That's right, because there's an ambulance match on that show.
Okay.
I was talking about how much I hate ambulance matches, and same thing. Like the finish has to be contrived because you have to get the guy into the ambulance.
Right.
So that same thing happened to Cena and Kane, and you saw a lot of outside stuff. But we also talked about this on a recent main event podcast, and that's that they don't do a lot of outside the ring stuff as they did, you know, probably from 98 to 2000 to 2003.
Right.
And this match is definitely rife with a lot of outside the ring stuff, which
it's
nice to see because you don't see it all the time anymore. If they started doing it all the time again, I'd get bored with it.
Right.
But
although JR points out that this is a no DQ, this is not a no DQ match, which is sort of unusual because most of the main events ended up being no DQ by default.
Yeah, right. And in fact, to the point where I know you're not a big video game player, but to the point where the video games, the WWE video games just started making all title matches no DQ.
That was the
default option setting because that's the way it seemed. Like even this one, Jim Ross says it's not a no DQ match, but I mean,
yeah,
it ends on a DQ, but like there's no way they shouldn't have been counted out for as long as they, you know what I mean? They were out there forever. You know, they go out there, they go all the way down the entranceway. you know, throwing them into the trailers and all that stuff. Like, they were out there for more than a 10 count.
Yeah.
Unless Earl Hebner was counting even slower than referees normally count, you know.
That's certainly possible.
Yeah, so it's just, I mean, that's just ridiculous. But, yeah, they fight back into the ring.
Yeah.
And
Austin does a superplex, mm-hmm. and then goes to the opposite corner, does another superplex, and then goes to the third corner, does a third one. At this point, Austin is holding his back at delaying the cover, and in fact, only gets two. Then he immediately tries another pin, and it also gets two, which I always enjoy the another attempt at the pin, you know, just to push down harder on the guy, see if that'll work.
Yep.
That's always good.
Yep. I've always liked the superplex, by the way. I think it's a great move.
Cowboy
Bob Orton's finisher for many years.
I don't think I've ever seen three in a row. That's sort of interesting.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, that is pretty interesting. It. I don't want to say more chops. I don't want to say that it makes the move look weak, because Austin does sell his back
right
long enough to make it like, you know, okay, you know, he's not moving. He's not taking advantage. You know, he's not trying to get the cover.
True. And it's not as if the superplex is really a finisher most of the time. I mean,
three of them in a row.
Yeah. But it's not like he hit three stunners and the guy kicked out. I mean, it's different from that. I mean, I get what you're saying and I agree with you. I just, it's not quite at a level where you're not ruining the move necessarily, you know, so to speak. No.
But this is one of the problems I have with WWE kind of in general,
mm-hmm.
Which is that, in so many cases, you know, the finishers, matches always end on finishers. Sometimes they end on roll-ups, which I like. But, I mean, how rare is it that a WWE match ends on a move other than a finisher?
I mean,
in Japan, that happens all the time. Guys went on with moves that aren't their finisher.
Yeah, unless you're in Survivor Series, then you'll win on, like, a transitional move if you're in an elimination match or Survivor Series. But
Right. But, I mean, even then, a lot of times it's a quick roll-up, and a quick roll-up happens. You know, that's the thing that happens, you know, pretty frequently. Like, a guy gets a schoolboy, or, you know, a guy gets a quick roll-up or a maestral cradle or whatever it is.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
And,
yeah, well, I like
maestral cradles anymore, but either way.
Yeah, I like, you know, having different ways to win matches. I think I would like it if everyone had, like, a secondary or even, like, a third finisher.
Yeah.
Right. Like, even if you want to keep the idea of finishers, at least, like, have a couple of options. So, I don't know. You have a number of ways to believably end a match.
Right. But, I mean, there are moves in Japan that are essentially considered finishers no matter who does them. You know what I mean? The cross arm breaker, for example.
Sure.
Anybody can really do it. It's not like any one particular guy is necessarily like their signature move.
Right.
But if someone puts it on, it's in the middle of the ring, it can finish a match for any number of different guys. You know, not necessarily being viewed as a finisher, just being viewed as a move that can finish a match.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, guys who have those kind of big time big time finishers, like the Burning Hammer is the best example, you know, of that, where, you know, it's like, he didn't do, the Burning Hammer. So I'm talking about Kenta Kobashi, by the way, for anybody who doesn't know. Kenta Kobashi didn't just do the Burning Hammer to finish a match. Like, he only used it, literally, he only used it 7 times.
Mm-hmm.
In his career. And it was a move that he busted out when he just could not put somebody away. Usually that somebody was Mitsuharu Misawa. You know, if he just couldn't put someone away, then it was Burning Hammer time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know,
Burning Hammer time, which is different from regular Hammer time.
Right. You don't have to stop before Burning Hammer time.
Right.
You know, and I think I would like to see more of that in American wrestling and WWE, to see guys with those kinds of things. Like, for a little while, they were doing it with Undertaker, where he would do the last ride, and if the last ride couldn't keep a guy down, then he would do a tombstone. But now they've kind of gone back to well, he hasn't wrestled in like a year, but they have in the past years kind of gone back to just letting him do the Tombstone all the time.
Right.
But for a while, it was the Last Ride, and if the Last Ride didn't do it, then once in a while he would bust out a Tombstone, and that was the end of it.
Yeah. It was kind of around this time. It's more like later in 2002, and particularly on SmackDown, where everyone kind of had a submission finisher and a a regular finisher, pin finisher as well. So they were kind of adding the variety. Like, I remember, you know, Lesnar had the Brock Lock, and of course the F5.
I don't even remember what the Brock Lock was.
It was basically like he draped the guy like over his back, if I recall correctly.
Oh, it was like a torture rack?
No, because he was like sitting, he was like laying down, but maybe he had the guy had the guy's like leg draped over his neck or something and kind of had him like curved kind of thing. I'd have to watch. I don't remember off the top of my head right now. And Edge had a submission, yeah. You know, like
the Educator. Is that what it was?
No, I can never keep the Edge pun moves straight. It was kind of like a sharpshooter, but he faced forward on the guy instead of facing backward.
Yeah, and Triple H had the he was using the Indian Deathlock for a little while.
Yeah, he did. He also used a sleeper for a little while.
Sleeper.
He beat Jeff Hardy with a sleeper. I remember. I think for the Intercontinental title. One of those matches they had. But anyway, so yeah, they go through periods where they kind of experiment with stuff like that, but they never go with like full bore certainly. But anyway. So Jericho, after the superplexes, is able to distract the ref and get a low blow, does some repeated elbow drops to the back, then punches and choking him with the ropes, then does a bunch of chops in the corner. He tries to lock.
No way.
Yeah, I know. He tries to lock him into the walls of Jericho, but Austin fights out. Then Austin catches Jericho and drops him onto the ropes, gets two out of that. Then Jericho sidesteps Austin, tosses him into the rail. Teases hitting him with the chair, but Austin avoids it. They fight around the tables. A little bit of awkwardness where it doesn't seem like they're quite sure on what to do there. They kind of just sort of mill around the tables. Like they tease a spot on the table, but then Hebner sort of gets them back in. That was kind of a weird like 30 seconds where it seemed like they weren't really clear on what to do.
Right.
And then Jericho gets a standing elbow, but misses the lion salt. He gets like a long sleeper, which JR sort of indicates might be a choke. And the crowd definitely sort of loses the match here a bit. They just not really much response to what's going on. And for an Austin, you know, and even Jericho match is, you know, kind of a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Austin tries to reach for the ropes, eventually goes down to the mat, and then his hand won't go down for three, and then he punches out of it.
Mm-hmm.
and then we follow with Austin trying the walls of Jericho, or looks like he's going to try the walls of Jericho, but then does the slingshot. Tries a back suplex, but Jericho rolls out. Then he tries a stunner, but Jericho avoids it, and then he clotheslines him down and hits the spine buster.
That's a great spine buster, by the way.
Yeah.
That is an excellent, that's one of the best spine busters, like, ever. He's so, like, just so quick and just snaps it right down, and Jericho takes the bump like a champ. That is a great-looking spine buster.
Mm-hmm. And then Austin catches Jericho in the air, and it's a power slam for two, which is an interesting move. I don't see that much from Austin. But Jericho is able to get a bulldog, and even though Austin is pretty far away, like he's more than halfway across the ring, Jericho hits the lion salt, but it's more of a glancing one. But then he follows it.
And then he does another one.
Yeah, it's
right?
Like when he's in the same position, but he lands it better, but it only gets two. Crowd still really isn't into this. But then again, lion salt was never really something that anyone bought as a finish. And always kind of, you know, like it's impressive that he can do the flip, but it never landed in a way where you thought, okay, that really hurt him very much.
Right.
So we get some more chops into a corner. Jericho misses a charge, but there's a cool spot where he counters the Luthez press attempt into the walls of Jericho.
Mm-hmm.
And locks it in, and then Austin stretches into the ropes, and is finally able to land them. Then Jericho goes out. He manhandles the timekeeper, and then he grabs grabs the title belt.
Poor Mark Eaton.
Yeah, yes.
This is a man who's just been abused endlessly.
Yeah, well, that's part of the job, I guess.
Yeah.
The ref is stunned, and then Jericho ends up getting spine-bustered into the belt. So his attempts to cheat fails him, but it only gets two. And then another really cool counter right after this is Austin tries the stunner, but Jericho hits the breakdown, which is the same as Jeff Jarrett's stroke, although I think Jericho
pushed
onto the belt. Jericho kind of alternated sort of the different finishers before settling on the Codebreaker. Like he did.
That wasn't until his comeback that he started using the
right. Code. But he did like a Cobra Clutch Slam for a while too, I think. After.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. So, the one he does now is definitely the best. Codebreaker is definitely the best of those type of finishers. But Jericho actually has like three finishers, I guess, if you consider the Lion Salt and the Walls of Jericho and the and the Codebreaker. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Codebreaker he stole from a Japanese guy. Which it's totally okay. We used to have conversations like these, at shows when I was wrestling. It's okay to steal from video games. It's okay to steal from the Codebreaker, it's okay to steal from video games. It's okay to steal from Japan, as Jericho did with the Codebreaker. Okay. There's certain places it's okay to steal from, and have it be all right.
It's good to know.
So
that's good wrestling logic, right?
That's
there.
Right. Jericho stole it from Japan, and that's fine. He can steal because nobody in the U.S. was using it. Nobody, most fans would know, was using it. So what's the difference? Well, why not?
Cool. Right?
So I don't remember who it was that he stole it from. I think it was Kenta, not Kenta Kobashi, but just Kenta, all caps.
Right. All caps, Kenta. So the breakdown lands right onto the belt, which is also nice, and it only gets two. Jericho tries to land another bulldog, but he gets tossed into the ref. Austin then locks his own walls of Jericho, and Jericho taps out, even though there's
no ref
to tap out. I never really understood. Like, I guess, okay, I get practically Jericho tapping out is a way to signal to the crowd that he's submitting. But I never understood the point of a wrestler not seeing a referee, knowing the referee's being knocked out, tapping. Like, I don't feel like the submission should make...
Maybe he's hoping that Austin will just let him go if he taps out.
Okay, all right. Maybe.
I don't know.
I always found that to be, like, sort of a goofy, like, okay, why is he tapping out when it's not signaling to anybody that you're submitting?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, he's signaling to his opponent, I guess. Maybe that's his hope.
Perhaps maybe Austin will have mercy on him. Like.
Yeah, right. Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's the only thing that I can ascribe that to. I don't know.
So eventually Austin releases it, and then Jericho grabs the belt, tries a belt shot, but then lands the stunner. Of course, we still have no referee. Then we have the NWO running in. Austin tries to fend them off for a bit, but they get a gang attack on him. But honestly, they don't do much. It's like, it's weird. Like,
they really don't. Like, you would expect to see Nash, like, powerbomb him.
Right, or something like that. I mean, maybe they were afraid because Austin's neck or something. Or somebody hit a chair shot or something. Something that would be, like, a heavy move that you would... Yeah, I mean, Hall gets the stunner, but it's a weak-looking stunner, and, it's, like, over really quick, and then sort of...
Hogan doesn't even leg drop him or any. I mean, right. Leg drop is a high-impact maneuver at
But it's over as a finisher, and, yeah, right. I mean, you could have done something like that. All three guys kind of get something big in, and then, just delayed, Jericho pulling in the referee and getting the pin 30 seconds, and that's obviously what happens is... Jericho wins the match and gets the belt, and then the NWO They attack Austin in the middle of the ring. Hall hits another stunner, which looks a little bit better. And then Hogan...
So, wait, maybe I'm misremembering this, which is weird because I just watched it. But is it a DQ or Jericho gets the... Jericho does pull the referee and get a pinfall, doesn't
Jericho
he?
Jericho gets the pin, yeah. Jericho wins it by pinfall.
Yeah, so why didn't they just have it as a no DQ match? That's dumb.
Well, that's a good question.
Especially since they kind of acted like it was one, since they were outside the ring and...
Right.
Nobody gets counted out, and I don't know.
Probably. I don't know. Not really great planning, I guess, on this one. But so yeah, Hogan goes outside, gets the spray paint to a pretty big face pop, and then Hall writes NWO on Austin's back, and that pretty much does it.
Yeah, that's it. And that was pretty much it. Like at the, if I remember, and again, this is 10 years ago now. So, but if I remember. You know, the NWO just left and Austin got up and I don't even remember if he cut a promo. I think he just got up and left. I don't think anything else really happened, you know, after the pay-per-view was over that I remember.
Right.
I think I knew and my friends, I think we were all pretty much in touch with the fact that Austin was going to lose. But I mean, people, it was really cool atmosphere. People were going nuts for the NWO, whether that was booing or cheering. And you can see watching the pay-per-view now that there are tons of people in NWO shirts. Obviously, they had just started selling NWO shirts again. I can't even imagine how many NWO shirts they sold that night.
Yeah.
Like I feel like I was the only person who didn't buy one. Like They must have sold at least, you know, I mean, the attendance in the Bradley, you know, sellout crowd in the Bradley Center is a little bit over 15,000 for wrestling thereabouts. So, I mean, I would not be surprised if they had sold, you know, 10,000 NWO shirts that night, you know. I mean, it's just crazy, you know, because that name still carries weight and, you know, it's, you could probably bring him back again and well, it's ill-advised, but there probably is a way to bring back the NWO and have it not be stupid.
Yeah.
But maybe you shouldn't.
yeah, I think that's better. Just let that one go. Leave the memories alone.
Yeah, which the problem is that there was never, ever a good denouement to that story.
No.
The NWO.
Yeah.
Ever.
No, that was kind of the problem. Yeah, they never really, WCW never really had an ending that was satisfying to that story, and they
neither did WWE.
Well, Vince
came out and was like, "It's over."
Yeah. Well, they did have some circumstances. I mean, you know, they had Kevin Nash, who was the leader of it, had gotten hurt. Scott Hall was gone, and Hogan had been out of it for a couple of months. So,
right, but that is not a satisfactory denouement.
No, I will say that like it was a 3 or 4 month story in WWE that had fallen apart, as opposed to, you know, a huge multi-year epic story that WCW had plenty of chances to end if they just had put a little thought into it. So those are different circumstances.
Yeah, I agree. I think the way WWE handled the Nexus angle. CM Punk stuff aside, because I don't think that was a good idea necessarily. I think there was two problems with the Nexus angle. I think they borderline ended it too soon, realistically speaking. But I also, I also think that dragging it out with CM Punk being the new leader and stuff didn't really work out. I think they should have just, like, if they were going to end it with John Cena dropping 8 million chairs on Wade Barrett's head, then they should have just ended it with John Cena dropping 8 million chairs on Wade Barrett's head.
Right.
But that even with the CM Punk stuff, and essentially he's like, I'm the new leader, Wade Barrett is a failure, and then Barrett going over and doing the core thing on the other show, which that was probably ill-advised too. But ultimately, like, that story had a decent arc, and I think it had legs. Like, that stable had legs. They had heat, even though most of the members weren't very good. The fact that they were doing similar thing to the NWO, I think out of fear of it turning into another NWO, they cut it a little bit short. But at least the thing initially, if you talk about the initial, you know, instance of the Nexus, it had an arc that made sense, and it ended at a point, or it should have, with John Cena, beating Wade Barrett with dropping all the chairs on his head. It had an arc that made sense, and it could have ended at a place that made sense.
Sure.
obviously the NWO had such legs that you wouldn't end it after 8 months or whatever, however long the Nexus thing was. It wasn't even that long. It was like 6 months or 7 months. Mm-hmm. The Nexus thing really, really went. Because even when CM Punk was a leader, it wasn't really like...
It wasn't the top. I mean, it was sort of like... I consider that like a separate story that didn't really go anywhere. I mean, it was a related story maybe, but...
Right. And it just kind of petered out. Like, there was never, like, it just, like, he was with the Nexus, and then he just started coming out, and then it was just CM Punk.
Really, it ended
anymore.
Like, yeah, it just kind of, I mean, he was with them up until he cut the promo.
His big promo, yeah.
Yeah, and then he just stopped being with them, and then they had that basically story, and they forgot about it.
But they were still tagging together for a while. McGillicuddy and Otunga were still tagging together after that for a while.
That's true.
You know, then it just kind of petered out and was done, which is not, I mean, that's not a horrible way to end it, just to be like, okay, well, we're just kind of let it go. And now the focus is obviously on CM Punk. And nobody really cared at that point. So it wasn't like, oh my God, what happened? I need to know. Like, yeah. It's just like, we don't care. But I think that the initial thing where they ended it with Wade Barrett and John Cena and that no holds barred match and Cena dropping the chairs on Wade Barrett, that's a good place to end it. And there is a way to end a story like that, and we never got that with the NWO.
Yeah,
and I'm not saying bring back the NWO just so we can get a satisfying conclusion. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the thing with Vince, or like, I understand the reasons that it happened, but things like that are always kind of an embarrassment in any medium. Like, comics have it. There's a lot of weird parallels between comics and pro wrestling, and I don't know how into comics you are, if you follow comics at all. But like DC's thing that they did last year, where they rebooted their whole universe, is the same thing as that, as the WCW reboot that we talked about in the Starrcade 2000 podcast, where, like, that's embarrassing to me. That tells me that, like, you have people who are not capable of handling your characters and have essentially written themselves into a corner to such a degree that you have no choice but to break the fourth wall and come out and say, either we're getting rid of this or we're just going to act like this never happened. And Vince McMahon coming out and saying, yeah, sorry, the NWO just isn't a thing anymore. Like, that is embarrassing. Like, that is like, really? That's how bad it is? You wrote yourself into such a horrible corner that you couldn't find a way out of this short of just breaking open the fourth wall completely and coming out and saying, sorry, we screwed up. This was terrible. We apologize. It's over now. Like, even the Mr. America thing, like, when they had a disagreement with Hogan and he wasn't under contract, at least they found a half-assed way that was story-related to get out of that.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't make... I mean, it was wrestling logic, right? But, like, at least it didn't involve Vince McMahon just coming out and going, the Mr. America thing, we're going to pretend it never happened. Like, the NWO thing, I would have to look up the promo, but that essentially was it. Like, he basically came out and was like, it's a failed experiment. Like, we're going to just act... We're just going to move on from here. Like... No, that's not a sad, like, you, that is the laziest writing in the universe, and you had to resort to that because you wrote such a poor story. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with DC's thing where they were like, we're going to reboot our whole universe. It's like, because that's what I really needed, right? Is that because I don't understand Batman, so I need you to start over with Batman again. Like, it's just lazy storytelling. It's like, we've written ourselves into a corner. We've done things with our characters that we don't feel like we can reasonably undo because at some point some idiot thought this was a good idea and we're sorry, but here's our, it's not even lazy. It's beyond lazy. Like, the Mr. America thing was lazy. This is beyond lazy. This isn't even lazy because you're not even putting in the effort to write anything. That's how lazy it is. It's just saying, yeah, forget that ever happened.
Yes.
Like, And that's how the NWO came to its end in WWE, is right. Just by Vince McMahon coming out and saying, sorry, pretend that never happened. Like,
oops.
Oops.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for that, Vince.
Now we'll have Brock Lesnar beat Ric Flair so I can control the entire WWE. Those are roughly the same period of time. I think that actually happened right before then, because that's what they did instead. Or no, they had Vince versus Flair, and then Brock came out to beat Flair, and then Vince controlled both brands. Again, that was just a strange. It was a strange summer.
Yeah.
You know, I thought during while we were talking about things, I thought of how this would have been totally awesome. is if basically what they did here, as they did, but Austin being able to fend off the NWO reasonably successfully, and then suddenly a fourth man jumping in and in an NWO t-shirt, and that man is Goldberg.
That would be fantastic.
And Goldberg is your fourth member of the NWO, and it's the four of them destroying, you know, WWE for a few months, and then, you know, and building up to a big match and everybody rallies. I mean, you could have even done just Austin Goldberg at the, you know, at WrestleMania. And I mean, that leads to it perfectly, you know, right there, which is obviously was the match. You know, if you, I mean, if you had Rock Hogan and Austin Goldberg on the same show, I mean, just, you know, I mean, just imagine that. I mean, that would have been fantastic.
Yeah.
So
no, definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah,
but
we didn't. We got other things instead. No, it is not. Mm-hmm. Oh well, we can dream. There is a parallel universe in which that happened.
Yes, and it is great.
Yes,
as opposed to the no wrestling parallel universe that I mentioned.
Right, which is a bad. Yeah, which is the worst of all possible universes.
Yes, yes,
yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, unless maybe there's one of the Nazis one that might be slightly worse. But.
Right, that's a Philip K. Dick story called The Man in the High Castle.
There's probably no wrestling in that universe though either.
No,
so.
Probably not.
Yeah,
probably not. So. Or maybe it's a universe in which Fritz Von Erich is a babyface.
Maybe, maybe.
That's probably a joke that's in poor taste, but
that's but, all right.
I don't know. This is again, like I said, this is kind of the. This is kind of the beginning of a downward trend in pro wrestling for me that I'm not a huge fan of. So, but this match it's decent. There's just so many chops, dude. I can't even keep saying that. I feel like I'm harping on it.
But you are harping on it a little bit, but that's
you have watch it again, man.
No, I mean I remember there. I mean I noticed there were a lot of chops. They didn't bother me as much as they bother you. But I mean clearly there are many chops. Clearly that is something that is strongly evident. But no question about that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I don't know. But it's a pretty decent little match. I mean, it's obviously Austin is getting very much towards the end of his career. His neck is in really rough shape. I remember hearing at the time that the reason that Hall wasn't doing the Outsider's Edge on him is because of his neck. They're worried that taking the Outsider's Edge could do, serious damage to his neck.
Sure.
So, I mean, you can tell Austin's on the way out. Jericho is obviously, I mean, he's Chris Jericho, but this is really, honestly, again, I guess maybe it's part of my expectations too. Like for these two guys, I would expect nothing less than, you know, amazing, great, brilliant.
And this was just pretty good.
Yeah, right. This is just, pretty good. It's pretty good. And I remember feeling the same way when I watched it live. I don't remember the chops thing bothering me as much, but I remember watching it live being like, yeah, that was an above average wrestling match.
Yeah. I mean, there was some innovative stuff in there. But yeah, there definitely also were a lot of chops. So.
Yep. Yep. There certainly were.
All right. Joe, is there anything that you would like to let my listeners know that you have going on?
You know the answer to that. You can find most of the things that I do at onthestick.com. You can find the On the Stick biweekly video game podcast there, of course. You can also find the Action Cast, which is an action movie podcast there. You can also now find What a Maneuver, which is the newest podcast in the On the Stick podcast network. And that is a podcast in which myself and my friend Eric Allen from On the Stick, we go ahead and what we're doing is we are chronicling the year 1996 in professional wrestling. We are watching every single episode of Raw and Nitro in their entirety from 1996 and talking about them on the internet. The first episode of that, if it's not up by the time this goes up, it will be up very shortly after that. And when it's up, it will be also be available on iTunes at that time. You can also find some of my wrestling writings and rantings at fairtoflare.com. I do a monthly column at fairtoflare.com, as I'm sure everybody who's listening to this is aware, because this is part of the Fair to Flare podcast network, of course, wherein I write about video games, wrestling video games. It's called The Virtually Squared Circle. You can find that at fairtoflare.com. New edition of that will be coming out soon, I believe. I need to get that penned in the next day or two and get that sent off to Jason here to edit and post, or KSP, I guess, might edit and post it. But that should be coming soon, or up by the time this podcast goes up. And that's about it, I think. Those are the things I do. So onthesick.com is really... Oh, and I'm on Twitter, of course, just like everybody else is. So you can find me on Twitter at @shake_well. I hope you like wrestling and video games, because that's what you're going to see a lot of if you check me out there. I also like punk rock and crappy horror movies, so you'll probably see a fair amount of that too. But that's what you'll get if you follow me on Twitter. I tweet a lot, so be prepared if that's something you you're going to do. But I do hope you follow me. I'm almost at 500 followers, so I'm pretty excited about that. So.
Cool. All right. Well, definitely, Joe's a great follow. I enjoy following him very much. So even though I'm not even into a few of the things he's into, he provides enough wrestling and other entertainment that I always enjoy what he's got to say. Mm-hmm. And thanks, of course, everyone for listening. Thanks, Joe, again for being on the show. Always a good chat that we have.
Always love doing it. Trying to break my record for digressions in an episode. I think I did it with this one.
I think we did pretty well, yes. Definitely, we digress on occasion. So, all right. Definitely, keep checking us out at WrestleSpective.com and FairToFlare.com. We have more podcasts coming. We always appreciate everyone, who listens. And we'll definitely appreciate people who take the time to leave a comment on iTunes. We're actually going to have a special show pretty soon. Some people who have taken the opportunity to comment on iTunes, and in exchange, I'm going to discuss various topics that they have sent me in the world of professional wrestling. So keep your eye out for that show. And thanks, everyone, for listening, and goodbye.